Good morning, everyone. Do you know what tomorrow is?
Sunday.
Just another day of the week. No, it's the first day of Pentecost. Count 50. First day of counting to the day of Pentecost. The Feast of Weeks. That's not my subject, however. That was just a test. Okay, now, I don't suppose you remember that somebody had a big plastic chicken up here one time for part of his sermonette. And, he set it right there, kind of a prop. Well, I don't have a big plastic chicken, but I do have a little furry creature here. On paper, it's the best I could do. Kind of a cute little thing, and we'll be talking more about him later. I call him Mascot. That's quite a name for him. We'll be meeting him again later. And by the way, he's paper trained, so don't worry. If I were to say that this is a split sermon about economics or economy, you would immediately fall into a trance. You know, you just look at me with an expressionless glare, economics, come on. Unless you're a CPA or some weird thing like that, you'd really have a problem with that. But I don't want anybody falling into a comatose state, because the word economy is rather an interesting word, really. It comes from the Greek, oikonomos, and that comes from two words, oikos meaning house and nomos meaning the administrator. So an economics person is one who is administering the household or taking care of all those things that need to be taken care of. It is the office of a manager, an overseer, the stewardship word used in the Bible quite often, the administration. This would include everything, financial, maintenance, cleaning, security, and so forth. So we are the oikonomos, the economists, the managers of our households, in whatever capacity you might be in. You're also the economist, the comptroller of our homes, and even our bodily homes. We are the managers of what we do, what we say, what we think, what we allow in, what we exclude. But let's focus on security, because that's part of the function of a manager. We must act as a guard to protect and do damage control. In the case of our bodily home, we prevent sin from breaching our walls, from coming in. To do this, we must know our enemy, sin, and its costs and effects. Not the cause and effects, but the costs of sin and its effects. I call it the economy of sin, which includes its elements, that is, the two types of sin. Now, if you're a Catholic, you'll be thinking mortal and venial. Well, it's not about that. There are two different types of sins, though. We will look at those and see the aggregate cost of sin in our lives, collectively and individually. We're not really that much different than our forefathers. I think that is an undeniable fact. Jeremiah, Psalms, and Daniel hold to that theme, that our fathers have sinned and we follow, sometimes blindly, sometimes boldly, in their footsteps. Blind and boldly, I call that balderdash, nonsense, foolishness. So the words kind of come together there, but that's my own warped thing of doing things with words. But we follow in our Father's footsteps many times. With that in mind, let's review the story in Numbers, chapter 14, verse 34. You might want to put a marker in your Bible there, because we'll be referring back to that area. We and our forefathers have come through the waters, whether it be the Red Sea, the Jordan, or in our case, baptism. A short time passes, and presently you appear before the judge. All peoples do. Or more precisely, the judge appears before you. In the case of Israel passing through the waters of the sea, their baptism of sorts, things happened within a couple of years, and now they face some very serious charges. The infractions may have seemed trivial at the time, sometimes even justifiable. But the sentence was pronounced by the judge for all of Israel, here in Numbers 14:34. After the number of days in which you, that is the spies, search the land, even 40 days each day for a year, shall you bear your iniquities, even 40 years, and you shall know my breach of promise. 40-year sentence. Their hearts sank. But was it only a 40-year sentence? Read verse 35. I, the Lord, have said, I will surely do it unto all this evil congregation that are gathered together against me in the wilderness. They shall be consumed, and there they shall die. It was more than a 40-year sentence. It was a death sentence for their sins. Why? It's explained in verse 22. Because all those men which have seen my glory and my miracles, which I did in Egypt and in the wilderness, and have tempted me now these 10 times, most of that was within 2 years, and have not hearkened to my voice, surely they shall not see the land which I swore unto their fathers, neither shall any of them that provoke me see it. We must follow God fully, as did Caleb, or we could forfeit our passage into the promised land, the kingdom. If we, like Israel, tempt, murmur, provoke, complain, are obstinate, rebellious, or question God's word or his power, if we do not put sin out of our lives, that is surely our fate. There are two types of sin that we have to consider. Acts 24, verse 16. The first is sins of ignorance, and they are those of which we are unaware, either from neglect, that is to say, I should have known better, or something else. And here's the something else. Remember Jiminy Cricket? Pinocchio's conscience? The advice was to always let your conscience be your guide. Whenever you face temptation, you were to give a little whistle, and his conscience, Jiminy Cricket, would kick in and kind of take over, guide him, give him guidance. Maybe it was just there to wake your comatose conscience. Everyone has a conscience. Everyone. Some are just more sensitive than others. Some are totally asleep at times. But we have something else. We have God's Spirit working in us to work with our conscience to show us what is right and wrong, if we let our conscience take over. Acts 24:16, and herein do I exercise myself to have always a conscience. So it takes work. You have to think about it. Be aware. That is, a conscience, which is Greek 4894, co-perception, moral consciousness, or self-awareness. Be aware of what you're doing. Most people just walk through life blindly. And what is that conscience to do? It's to regulate our behavior. It is why we put leveling out and do some serious self-examination at this time of the year. The conscience is to be, as we read in verse 16, a conscience void of offense toward God and toward men. A double thing again. John Gill's commentary says this about conscience. I thought this was really well done. We are to have always a conscience void of offense toward God and toward man. That is, to discharge every duty which God requires and to give to every man what is due him, so as to please God and not offend men, neither Jew nor Gentile, nor the church of God. And so as that conscience may be clear of guilt and may not be defiled with sin, being purged and purified by the blood of Christ, by a conscience void of offense, is meant a good conversation, which as it respects God, lies in a carefulness not to offend him, but to do his will. And as it respects men, a shunning what may give offense or stumbling to them. And through this, and though this cannot be perfectly attained to in each case, in each of its branches, yet there is in every good man a concern to have such a conscience. So deep down inside, you know what is right and wrong. And especially us who have God's Spirit guiding our conscience. A conscience void of offense toward God and men. Luke has gone from preaching to meddling here. Have I ever had a guilty conscience toward men? I can think of a half a dozen or so people that I need to apologize when I come up in the resurrection. And they do too. Now, it wasn't a malicious or hurtful thing that I meant, but nevertheless, I caused some grief to certain people. It was more out of ignorance than anything else, or carelessness, but nevertheless, the hurt was the same. Both offending God and man, ignorantly or presumptuously, it doesn't really make much difference. It requires a sacrifice. One was a bullock, one was a she-goat. Think about that. At that time, I will be a spirit being, and those people that I've offended will come up. What? Me bow before them? I will be God. They should be bowing to me. And then I remember, Jesus Christ bowed himself before man to death. Different way of looking at it. Hebrews 5, verse 14. This echoes what we just read in Acts 24, verse 16. Hebrews 5 and verse 14. But strong meat belongs to them that are of full age. To whom? Even to those who by reason of their reason of use or exercise, have their senses exercised to discern both good and evil. Exercising the senses, the five senses, for knowing the difference from right or wrong is most definitely referring to the conscience. We surely want strong meat in our lives. We need it desperately. That is solid, stable spiritual nourishment. So we've got to exercise our senses to get that. Matthew and Luke tell us the same thing about what happens when we don't exercise our seeing and hearing, two of those senses. For the heart of this people is waxed gross, and their ears are dull of hearing, and their eyes have they closed, lest they should see with their eyes and bear with their ears and understand with their heart and should be converted, and I should heal them. Paul reiterates the thought in Hebrews 5, verse 11. Speaking of the heart of the people, Paul says this, of whom we have many things to say and hard to be uttered, seeing you are dull of hearing. That word is used, dull. What a sad thing to say about the people of God, and hard to be uttered, seeing you are dull of hearing. What they really needed was the spiritual meat that God had for them. So they were dull of hearing. May we say that the Israelites were dull of hearing, or the early church, or we are dull of hearing? A synonym for dull is stupid. You think that's too hard a word? How about sinful? Remember Jiminy Cricket? I've replaced him with this furry little guy, my mascot. Note the condescending look. The caption says, "I'm not saying you're stupid. I just think you've got bad luck when it comes to thinking." Boy, that really struck me when I saw that picture. That would certainly be appropriate for many groups and individuals today. And yes, I picture him sitting on my shoulder, giving me that same quizzical look. Let's shift over now to presumptuous sins. From sins of ignorance to the second type. Hopefully, we probably don't indulge in these types of sins often. They are deliberate, willful, predetermined acts of provocation to God. Sin is a word so convicting, so unpopular, it is about falling out of use. Do you ever think about that? We say, it was a bad judgment, or you made a poor choice, or that was an unprofessional decision. But sin has consequences. The ultimate consequence, of course, is found in Romans. For the wages of sin is death, but the gift of God is eternal life. We can deduce from that they are diametrically opposed. The wages of sin is death, but the gift is eternal life. It's a choice, isn't it? Just like sin is a choice. This verse is so important, so unequivocal, so conclusive that we should put it on our doorposts of our mind along with the Ten Commandments and read it every morning. Here are the verses that speak of ignorant and presumptuous sins. I'll abbreviate these verses for time. First, it speaks of a collective sin of ignorance as if we were all guilty of the same thing. Is that possible that we could collectively be guilty of a sin? Numbers 15:24. Then it shall be, if aught to be committed by ignorance, without the knowledge of the congregation, that all the congregation shall offer one bullock for a burnt offering, and the priest shall make an atonement for all the congregation. And it shall be forgiven all the congregation of Israel and the stranger that sojourns among them, seeing all the people were in ignorance. Now it speaks of an individual committing a sin of ignorance, this one person. And if any soul, individual, sin through ignorance, then he shall bring a she-goat of the first year for a sin offering, and the priest shall make an atonement for the soul that sins ignorantly when he sins by ignorance before the Lord. And in verse 30, it shifts to the presumptuous sins. But the soul that doth aught presumptuously, whether he be born in the land or the stranger, the same reproaches the Lord, and that soul shall be cut off from among his people. It doesn't include presumptuous sins here, collective presumptuous sins, but in the matter of the Amorites in Deuteronomy 1 and in Korah's rebellion, there definitely was a conspiracy, a united effort to conspire to rebel. Numbers 14:33. And your children shall wander in the wilderness 40 years and bear your whoredoms. Your children shall bear the consequences of your unfaithfulness. That's kind of a sobering thing for parents to think about. The children of those condemned to die in the wilderness were to suffer the consequences of the sins of the fathers, as were those 70,000 men who died of the pestilence because David sinned in numbering Israel. How'd you like to have that on your conscience? And then there is David's son that died because of his father's sins. And don't forget Achan, who was found with the accursed thing in his tent and caused at least 36 of God's people to die and 3,000 men to flee before the enemy. No matter how large or how small our sin, and some of those don't seem that much. I mean, the guy stole some booty they had collected from a war, caused a lot of death. Simple little thing. You wouldn't think stealing would cause death. I don't want to be responsible for those things. Do you? I guess it's something we have to work on. Thinking of the children again during the Exodus, think of what they endured because of their adults' rebellion. Daddy, why do we have to eat manna all the time? Daddy, why do we have to move in this hot sun? Daddy, didn't God say, I will bring you out of the affliction of Egypt and into the land of the Canaanites, Hittites, and so on, unto a land flowing with milk and honey? Daddy, why don't I have any honey for my manna? Daddy, are we there yet? Be quiet, just keep walking. I think that would be a typical answer that we might give, rather than admit our faults and change. Just keep walking. It's hard to admit when we act stupidly or when we sin, so we just keep walking. Now, it's amazing what you learn about yourself when you read biblical stories and examples in front of the mirror of your past experience. I discovered something about myself after 35 or 40 years when I was reading the story of Korah's rebellion. You see, Korah, Dathan, and Abiram, and 250 men didn't like the way things were being run. They didn't like what was going on, and they didn't wait to ask God's opinion to see what he was going to do about it. They just split. They rebelled. They didn't wait for God to do things in his time or his way. And the old wind was blowing strong in that feast in 1978 or 79 at the Wisconsin Dells. And I left Worldwide Church of God. Things were going very badly, and every sermon got worse and worse. First time I'd ever experienced that in the church in 40 years. Finally, on the last day, it got so bad. They were self-aggrandizing and preaching, you know, horrible things. And after we left the feast that year, I left. Did I act prematurely? Did I act ignorantly? Did I act presumptuously? Maybe a mixture of all three. And I awoke when I read this story about Korah. My mascot was on my shoulder. And I saw that incriminating look on your face, on his face. And I didn't say you were stupid. I think you just have bad luck when you come to thinking sometimes. I mean, why would that wait that long before I realized what I had done? It was a wake-up call after 35 years. It's not to say that in certain situations, when things become totally, doctrinally, and morally corrupt, like the Worldwide Church of God eventually became, you may have no choice but to leave. But back then, things were in the wind. You know, it wasn't a big deal. Maybe God would have straightened it out in due time. Had I and everybody else in the congregation been praying about the problems instead of bad-mouthing, talking about it. Just my opinion, but I thought that I was kind of culpable there. But we can see that I walked in the wilderness, so to speak, for 25 or 30 years. And it was an interesting thing. But, you know, God can protect you in the wilderness. He protected Israel in the wilderness. And he did me. You can learn and grow. He can protect you. Those two cans are provisional. Simply, if you are faithful, regardless of what you do, what has transpired, what has happened. After all, I was delivered from Egypt, that is sin, just like Israel. They had to take the long way around, though, because of their rebellion. Let's talk for a moment about costs. How would every one of you like a check for $5,414 every year? A few of you? Actually, this is, all this information is based on something written back in 1999, so I know that the costs have escalated tremendously because of various reasons. But the cost of crime was estimated at $1.7 trillion. The U.S. population is 314 million. That's a cost per person of $5,514. A major sin induced. Hidden cost is financial, and that cost is the estimate of David A. Anderson, an economist teaching at Davidson College, Kentucky, in January 1999. Anderson's study, entitled The Aggregate Burden of Crime, estimates that all of the direct and indirect costs of every type of crime for the entire nation. He takes into account all costs which would not exist in an ideal society free from crime, sin. He breaks crime costs down into four major categories. Crime-induced production costs about $400 billion per year. That includes products and activities that do not contribute to society except in their association with crime. The examples include the production of personal protection devices, trafficking of drugs, and that constitutes about $200 billion per year. It also includes the operation of correctional facilities. Opportunity costs represents lost productivity due to the people's incarceration or criminal activity. If they were engaged in illegal pursuits, their activity would benefit society instead. Anderson estimates that each incarcerated inmate in the U.S. represents $23,000 in lost productivity per year. Additional opportunity costs arise from the time spent securing assets, purchasing and installing crime prevention devices, such as airport and library security systems, and patrolling neighborhood watch areas. Anderson estimates the total opportunity cost of crime to society is $130 billion. I think he's way too low on that particular estimate. I think those have escalated tremendously. Transfers represents the losses to victims of theft and unlawful deception that are balanced by gains to criminals who acquire the stolen goods or money. Anderson estimates that cost at $603 billion annually, including the cost of fraud, unpaid taxes, and health insurance fraud. I feel that many costs have since gone up tremendously since then because of the cost of computer hacking, identity theft, insider trading, foreign and domestic terrorism. This has all come about mostly since 1999. The second thing we need to look at is social costs. Now, many of these costs are hidden and are those that affect the quality of life, which is a very interesting way to look at the cost of sin. Anderson includes this in calculating financial costs, but the issues are more social than economic. That is, they change our attitudes, our behavior, our trust, and so forth. He lists it as the value of risks to life and health, and it is a difficult cost to ascertain, representing the fear of being injured or killed, the anger associated with the inability to behave as desired, and the agony of being a crime victim. Anderson calculated that the 72,111 crime-related deaths back in 1999 cost $440 billion annually. I'm not a CPA. I don't even hardly understand change for a 20. And the 2.5 million injuries from drunk driving, arson, rape, robbery, and assault cost $135 billion a year. More intangible costs are what sin does to trust, love, and social behaviors, like the reaction and fear and paranoia of the school shootings. The immediate reaction was, right or wrong, to put more policemen into the schools. Big cost. And it also adds to our apprehension about sending our children to school. We can see the effects of, even in the scriptures, about what happens when sin pervades. The sons of Aaron, Eli, and Samuel, man, these guys were big names, but they're children. Because of their immoral behavior, people reacted and rebelled. So sin begets sin, and it costs. They ignored the wise counsel of waiting on God. as expressed in Psalm 57 verse 3, which says, "He shall send from heaven and save me from the reproach of him that would swallow me up." Selah. God shall send forth his mercy and his truth. God will send forth mercy and truth in his time, his way. Selah is a notation used in music and in comedy and speaking, as far as that goes. It's a break to allow one to catch and reflect on a point or a moment. Importance. I like what the Amplified Bible notes about the word Selah. Pause and calmly think about that. There's a lot of information here. We have to think about it, exercise our conscience. When your conscience is working, you can know when your conscience is working when you think, that doesn't seem right. I've got to check on this. What was I thinking? And so on. You will have resistance, and resistance generates heat and thought. It's like exercise, exercising your conscience. We must be both weak and strong. Kind of a oxymoron there. As Paul said, when I am weak, then I am strong. Does Satan attack your weaknesses or your strength? Obviously, he can attack anywhere he wants. And he does. He can attack our weaknesses. But I think, as I thought about this, I think he attacks us more on our strengths, or at least those places where we think we are strong. That's why when we think we are strong, we need to become weak, put our reliance and trust on God. That's what happened back in the Old Testament so many times. People thought they knew better. And we have that same problem because we follow the problems of our fathers. This is not a place for weaklings or for ignorance or for our own strength. Sin carries a huge cost financially and socially. And while sin is a constant danger, we have great confidence and hope because this season also represents the very positive theme of deliverance. Yeah, sin, but also deliverance. Despite the obstacles, temptations, and sins we encounter, God is faithful and will see us through. He saw me through 30, 35 years. What a lot of lessons to be learned here and instruction. It's a history of God's people, a reflection of our ancient past, and a mirror of the present, and the promise of deliverance now and in the future, if we are faithful. Selah.